Bay put Lee Iacocca's career in jeopardy. So that's an intention. That's an attention getter. You know, I thought, Jesus Christ. I don't know what the hell he's saying, but I mean, it's interesting. So anyway, I got that message, and I don't. There certainly was nothing I did that ever did put him in jeopardy. But there was. It said something about the atmosphere of concern that I don't. That remains mysterious to me. I turned out a lot of cars, a lot of good, you know, interesting designs, and I had this running battle with Harold MacDonald, who thought that the whole subject of downsizing was repugnant to him. I did a whole series of downsized Continentals, four doors, two-door Continentals, and a new Ford four-door sedan, all on the, and of course I used unitized construction as my approach to lighten the car and reduce the dimensions and so forth. But Harold MacDonald, he's a brick. I mean, there's no way you can move Harold MacDonald. I mean, to this day. I mean,
was he the engineering?
Yeah, he was chief engineer.
Yeah, right.
And there was no way he was having any of De La Rosa. In fact, to him, of course, what the hell would De La Rosa know about this? You know, he's a goddamn stylist, so, you know, he can't know anything about it. Jean Bourdonnais was very supportive of me and collaborated with me on this. And Jean did his part in trying to turn Harold around. In fact, as I recall, Jean took the subject up with Iacocca a number of times, but unsuccessfully. But we, our time okay?
No, you're fine.
Okay. We had a one little vignette that really was a pleasing little relatively unimportant thing, but in a environment like I was in, where as good a reception as I got from the, for instance, I brought shipped my cars in air freight. We'd bring them in and maybe in batches of maybe just two or three at a time, and then I'd show them to Harold MacDonald's advanced engineering subcommittee, as I think it was called, and we'd show them in the dome. I'd give a podium start with slides on, you know, how's Gia doing. I'd give that, and then I would have the cars under wraps in the dome, and we'd take the group out and show them the cars. It got to be a very popular thing with the people. I was turning opponents into supporters, you know, rapidly. And in fact, one day, late in the day, I got a call. From an individual, I can't remember who it was, called me frantically about a board meeting the following day. Apparently they'd had I guess it was the result of a board meeting. And I think the call came from out of town, as I recall, New York or wherever. Anyway, the call came in about from this individual, and he said the board is asking some questions about, in fact, a lot of questions about what we're doing at Ford on small cars. And he said, you know, you and I know that they're doing Zip, you know. And he says, you've got all the small cars, our Ghia cars. He said, could you get those over, you know, out of storage? I rented storage from Park Davis in Allen Park just to keep them from getting banged up and destroyed. And I said, I'd be delighted. I said, I've got some unitized Continentals and Lincolns and Fords and stuff. He says, well, sure, bring those along. So anyway, it was like, you know, could you do it? Either it was like some fantastic demand, like either the next morning or at noon the next day or something, you know. So we trucked all these Ghia cars, and we had a hell of a lot of really nice-looking cars. I wish I had the books here to show you. If this is going to continue, I'll bring the books in, because I've got the whole Ghia file. It really is interesting. So I brought all of these cars, because what I'd been doing, because of the, there was an absolute, at the direction of Henry Ford, there was an express position of no interest in front-wheel drive cars, even though they had the Fiesta. But as far as he was concerned, that was the end of the subject. So obviously, to use the Fiesta drivetrain and platform, of course, limited me as far as the range of cars that I could do. So I bought cars in Italy, Lancias, which had a nice front system of the V4 engine, and I'd cut the sheet metal off, and we'd do our drivable cars on the Lancia basis. And so I had a nice array I had done a mini Mustang based on the Fiesta with a front system, and I had a number of mini Maxes and two door and four door sedans, all front wheel drive. Interestingly, slightly smaller. But not much, slightly smaller than the K car, ironically, many of them, yeah. And they have some of the, you'll see in the pictures, some of them have some of the K car two-door and two-door LeBaron kinds of looks on them. And I bought the Continental and the Lincoln and the new Ford and so forth. I brought that all over. Well, the board was just ecstatic over what they saw.
This is the board of the Ford Motor Company.
Ford Motor Company, board of directors. Nothing ever came of it.
Really?
No, nothing, no.
What do you think happened?
Well, that board was known, was described to me as being whatever it is, they use the term in business, where your board is a friendly board. It's a board that goes through the exercise of attending the meeting, but whatever management wants, management gets.
A handpicked board.
Right. That's what they were, and they'd ask a lot of embarrassing questions of Ford, and when they looked at the Ghia cars, of course, they were given the impression that Ford was hard at work on front-wheel drive cars, downsized cars, which they were not, and they did not. I mean, it was funny. They just absolutely, they were unmoved by the board of directors, and they dug their heels in, and they stayed right where they were, and that's the way Henry.
Was chiefly responsible for that obtuse attitude.
Oh, I think Henry Ford.
Pretty much.
Oh, he even admitted it publicly.
Yeah.
That
he
said, I made a mistake. Yeah. He said, I didn't believe it. I even showed, I didn't have that great a relationship with Henry Ford, but I, at times I would be in a situation where we would be showing Ghia cars, we'd be take them over to the test track, and we'd have a real dog and pony show, and at times in the walk arounds I'd find myself, not intentionally, but I'd find myself walking with Henry, and
explaining things.
And he would on several occasions, he remarked, I explained it, he said, boy, that's a beautiful car. I said, well, thank you, that's came out of Ghia. That was a Fairlane replacement that we did. And, but Henry, and I explained it was front wheel drive and so forth. Well, it that never went anywhere with Henry, and you know, he pleased me because he said, you know, it's a beautiful looking car, and he looked at the Mini Maxes on many occasions, but he the internal hierarchy of the company was impossible to move on such subjects as the you know, in the fight about unitized versus frame constructions, things like that. And Henry was not interested in getting into that and so forth. So
you had yourself and presumably Mr. Iacocca and Bourdonnais pushing for a European downsizing, which of course was right in tune with what was happening internationally, and you had a stone wall.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was Harold Sperlich involved in that also?
No, he wasn't really. Harold was, whose office was next to mine. Harold was really the mover and shaker for Lee on the Greenfield operation in Spain,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Uh-huh.
And he depended on Harold to go and knock heads over in Florida, Europe to get the job. I was just reading about an article, I should give it to you, a copy of it here, an article about Uwe Bonson.
Oh, yes, you did give
your comment. Oh, I did give you a comment,
right.
Because excellent designer, but, you know, and has made a career and is being respected, I think, worldwide for being a man of, that is, has fixed opinions and is not easily moved.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was frequently going to Germany and to England or Germany to, and you know, and this is kind of interesting because it's you say, well, it's hard to understand. They would send me over there because to do, because they could not get that man to do what they wanted to have done,
mm-hmm.
in, you know, Dearborn. It's like, you know, he'd tell them to get lost, you know,
uh-huh.
And he would tell them that, and he'd make it stick.
Mm-hmm.
They'd say to themselves, Jesus, I mean, that car, I don't like the looks of it. We want one done differently. We'll send Della Rosa over there, and he would give me a crew of modelers and a tech support person. And I would do a Dearborn version, and you know, and that has to be an unusual way to approach business. I mean, I was always amazed. I didn't mind doing it. It was kind of a little, you know, interesting and so forth. But you know, he persevered, and to this day, he's unmovable. I mean. You know, his cars are not selling, and you know, his trucks are in trouble on their trucks. And but Uwe Bonson is alive and well, and you know, and he's gotten credit for being a guy who isn't a wimp. You know, he's a God damn it. If Uwe Bonson says that's, you know, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. Weird, very strange.
To the Sierras, he's being hailed at.
Yeah, he's hailed at it, but the Sierra is being discounted, and you know, I mean, and they're up to their ass in Sierras, and their Intercontinental is not selling, you know. So I don't know. I mean, it's a funny business, you know.
Yeah. You must have felt rather frustrated that you're having Ghia produce these marvelous small cars and nobody's buying them. I mean, at the company level. What was Iacocca's? He had to be rather careful at this point, did he not, having come off the news thing. Was he giving you tacit support, but he wasn't able to field it at the executive
level?
Yeah,
I often wondered where he was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like I one day, in fact, during the last days, really, I didn't know they were going to be, but
right.
During the things were winding down, and I under my own work plan, I decided to do a because they were struggling with it in Dearborn. I mean, there was number one, they didn't want a front-wheel drive car, and there was so much bickering about it. I didn't know where he was, but I thought it would really be neat to do a Mustang. So this was, I think I presented it as a Mustang replacement.
Mm-hmm.
But it was bought a Volkswagen Scirocco.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the sheet metal off of it, and I designed and built a targa-roofed sports car with a rumble seat, and it had a little windshield that folded down and everything.
Yeah.
And then, as a ploy, I used the colors. Very similar colors, with accented with the orange wheels of one of his favorite cars, his Model A coupe. He has with a roadster with a rumble seat. So
right.
This had a metallic brown and with the orange wheels on it and so forth. And I didn't tell Gene about it or Lee or anybody. And finally, we air freighted the car in, and I invited, Lee was over in Gene's office, and I invited him to come down to the studio, and I told him I had a surprise for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I showed him this car. God, he really flipped. He thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. In fact, he got into a big flap with Henry over when he was fired. He wanted to buy that car.
Oh,
they wouldn't let him have it.
No.
That pissed him off.
Yes, I got it.
God.
Ghia had been a growing force in European design, and its influence on American design was somewhat glacial in this period, but it was moving, and you were accelerating this with your tenure as head of Ghia. Had Di Tommaso left by this time?
Oh, yes, right. Yeah. He left.
The conditions of taking over that he was to leave.
Yes, right. Yeah, he left.
So you had inherited a marvelous cadre of creative design people.
Yes, right.
And modern.
And craftsmen,
Craftsmen, yes.
Yeah, right. So I had 70, I think somewhere around 75 people.
Incredible, yeah.
And never had many designers. I never wanted many, quite frankly.
Yeah.
In fact, I only had I only had four. I'm not a. I really don't work that way. With huge staffs of. It isn't that I imagine myself as the person that's going to do all of it single-handed, but I had a very talented leader there, a design director.
Who was that?
I'll catch up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Cipino, Filippo Cipino,
mm-hmm.
Very talented man.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up with, I think we ended up with just three designers and Filippo.
Was Tom Chardon there at that point?
For a time he was, and then he left, and Tom was went out. He went to Fiat, I think, worked in Advanced, and then Tom followed in some sequence there, followed by filing a suit against us for employment suit against us.
You're in Turin at this point, aren't you?
Right. Yes.
And how did you interface in terms of design decisions with Ford of Europe and Dearborn? How did you pull that all together?
Well, not terribly well with Ford of Europe. Ford of Europe never liked the fact that I was there, and viewed me as a something of a an opponent, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we did some facelift work on on the Granada, and a facelift work on the Corsair.
Right.
We sold the facelift work on the Corsair. It wasn't a real pride and joy, the molding treatments, but we did a real nice freshening action on the Granada, but they weren't about to let that, De La Rosa and being a Dearborn, they viewed me as a Dearborn agent, and coming into Europe, that was very unpopular. The most unsuccessful, but the most beautiful car I think that I did over there was the Marbella.
How do you spell that?
Yeah, it's spelled Marbella.
Marbella, okay, fine.
I have some pictures of it too.
Oh, okay.
And if time permits, I'll tell you a little vignette on the Marbella.
Please do, if you have time.
It was a beautiful car. It was a two-door. My whole motive in doing the car was to fill a void that I felt existed. I don't have any qualms about saying that I was absolutely 100% right too. There was a void that I felt that existed in their program in Europe in the two-door market. They had no luxury two-door. Yeah, none. They didn't appear to want one. Fiat owned the market with the Fiat 130, and I decided that I would build a Granada, and I would get it shipped down to Gia, and we'd cut it apart, and we'd build a luxury coupe. And we did. So, it as I say, it turned out it was just dynamite. It was beautiful. So,
can you describe it in design terms?
In a sense, it looked like I was trying to revisit the Mustang that I lost in the shootout with Fritzy.
You'd always kept that image.
Yeah, right. And this was just a longer roof area, and it was fabulous.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't know how I even accomplished this, but I ended up with Lee in a trip to Europe, to even though I wasn't on the I didn't I somehow I even I even got on the agenda over there in Europe, over in Germany. And I had all my, I had my slides and everything with me, and my my handouts and the whole works. So I ended up in this conference room that you know had De La Rosa and Gia and the Marbella on it. Nobody knew what the hell it was or anything about it. So
you kept it under wraps.
I kept it under wraps. And nobody'd seen the car. Lee had never seen it, or you know. So a lot of this makes you wonder as you think, what the hell was, how the hell did this ever happen, you know? Well, I got up and I started making I went through my presentation. I was sensitive to the fact that I was really had my neck out a mile. The guys in Europe didn't want to know about it. I didn't until this day know how much Henry Ford didn't want to know about it. This evolved later on in the day. But it began to evolve when, as I went through the, went through it very rapidly, showed the slides of the car, described its marketplace, and so forth and so on, and I didn't sense at that time. I finished. I didn't know that I had upset Henry. Yeah, but as I'll finish up the story, you'll see that I did. So nobody. It was almost like they acted as though I hadn't made a presentation. Really, they, you know, nobody said a word. Lee didn't say a word. Nobody said a word. Henry didn't say. Nobody did. The people in Europe didn't say a word. No. So I sat down. So that night, I was invited to a castle, at which all of the 40 Europe people that are involved in product were invited, and all of the marketing people and the people from Dearborn who were guests, including Henry, were all involved. Were invited out here for dinner, and so I was invited. I rode out. I didn't, you know, I rode, there were some cars, some limousines, and I got a ride out there. I wasn't with anybody. Like, nobody wanted to be with me, I think, really, as I look back on it. So I got out there, and I noticed Henry, I saw Henry a couple of times. With a glass of champagne. That's not, you know, that's not unusual or for any kind of a party like that. So finally somebody rang a gong and we all were directed into this beautiful banquet area. And there were not, the tables weren't named, and are not, there were just, they were, I think they were numbered tables, but I just picked a table. I didn't use my head. I ended up picking a table. It turned out that I was within sight. I was at the next table to Henry. So Henry got up, and he got up to the podium, and I frankly don't remember his words, but it was a blistering, a blistering attack on me, and this, you know, this stupid car. I mean, he was you know, well into the champagne, and it showed a little bit, but he was not so far gone that he couldn't he couldn't articulate his thoughts, and he blasted me. And afterwards, it was interesting. There were two reactions from people in the guests there. One group felt that it was important that they come over and tell me that, you know, don't be too up, everything's going to be all right. Then there was another group that didn't want to come near me, you know. It was funny. Oh, God.
It was the Marbella that
Marbella.
Or the Marbella that had said
Marbella. That yeah. Turned him. And so.
Did you find out why?
I never did.
I never did.
I tried. You know what I did? I shipped the car over to the United States,
mm-hmm.
and I put it in the lobby of the world headquarters,
mm-hmm.
hoping to bait him into a confrontation.
Oh, that's marvelous.
But he never responded. I had that car there for. Oh, I must have had it there for 2 weeks. I have photographs of it taken mm-hmm. in the lobby. It was by the pool. Oh, Marbella, built by Ghia.
Oh
yeah, right. It was all there. But I couldn't bring him out on that. It was just like he went from his office by express elevator down to the garage. It was like he never came out into the lobby, and nobody wanted to tell him it was there. It was funny. The only guy that really got upset by it was Bourdonnais, who had it destroyed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he had it destroyed.
I'm trying to ask you about Bourdonnais' role in this whole episode.
Well, he never had a role in it, but he got a little anxious over the over that, so he had it destroyed. So. As peculiar as it is, and probably unusual to admit it, I do thrive on those things.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, and I can, you know, some of the things I do is have been kind of screwy, but I enjoy winning those things, and I went right to the wire with that, and that was a hell of a car. And I'll bring all those photographs in the next time you're out. September 18th, 1984, and this is Dave Crippen in the Edison Institute's Design History Series, and we're speaking today with Mr. Don Della Rosa, Vice President for Design at Chrysler, who will continue his narrative of his experiences at Ford and at Chrysler.
During the just a little background on my retirement, I had. After I'd been through the experience, I'd have to say I had developed a desire and been carrying this desire for many years to retire early. I think this is not unique with me. I think a lot of men consider this, and I think that many of them succeed quite well and are quite happy in the in that environment. However, in my case, after early retirement took place, I left immediately, left the Detroit area and went to Boca Raton, Florida, where we had a condominium on the ocean, and we'd had for a number of years, and I went down there with the expectation that I would be participating with my wife in a business venture that. She had been the primary person in that for a number of years, and after getting down to Florida, I realized that number one, perhaps, there was really, it was her effectiveness in the business was had reached a point where there really wasn't any place for me to either serve the business effectively or derive any particular pleasure out of it. I bought a car that I had always admired, treated myself to that, a 450 SL Mercedes, put the top down and proceeded to tour around Boca Raton and generally waste my time and began to gather the and develop the reaction to this this experience, which, as I said earlier when I started this narrative, that was turned out to be very disappointing to me. When I one thing I have neglected to mention, which I think is probably should be included, is that when I left Ford, Lee Iacocca called me and asked me to join him at Chrysler, and I was still on this bent that I had been on for a number of years. And no, I wanted to retire and go to Florida and so forth. So I had to deliver that to that reaction to him, which I don't think went over terribly well. As the months went on in Florida, of course, we first realized that our condominium that had been such a pleasure to enjoy as a kind of a turnkey place to visit maybe 2, 3, 4 times a year wasn't of a size that would could be serve comfortably as a home. This really had never impacted on me. So we decided to build a home out in the Estancia West, in the west part of out west of Boca, on just off of Glades Road. So we selected a site we thought was we thought that was a good choice. We'd selected a nice cul-de-sac and had the home built and had a pool and had screens put over pools. I noticed that everybody had to have screens, so I assumed that there were bugs after all, although I'd lived in a bug-free environment along the ocean. I didn't realize the bugs had all been blown inland. So we got this home done. And of course, from the point of view of what time of year, this was of considerable importance, because this this was getting to be spring, and spring was going into we actually moved in May or June, and of course the weather was heating up, and I had convinced myself that the temperature, being what it was on the ocean, and I was a little kind of fed up with all the breeze, which is looked upon by many as just, you know, greatest thing since sliced bread. But to me, it was just too much wind, too much breeze. So I thought, well, you know, going inland, it'll be really really a treat. We'll have there'll be breeze, but it will be more pleasant. And so anyway, as we as we're sitting in the screened-in patio area around the pool at night, we began to experience what it's really like. It was absolutely still. It was black as if you'd walked into a coal mine with the lights out, and there was the air was still, the temperature was high. And the silence, this high temperature, the combination of the two, and a humidity level that made it feel as though somebody had you around the throat. You know, it was just it took only a matter of a week or two of that experience, and fortunately, it was my wife shared this and reacted this way to it. We realized we had made a mistake. So I called Lee and told him that I had had a change of mind and would like very much to join him at Chrysler, and he was pleased, and we fortunately hit the market at the right time down there. It hadn't temporary slight recession which followed hadn't begun yet, so we were able to sell the house in a matter of a week, I think, or thereabouts. So here we are with headed back with a to Detroit, and we had kept our home in Bluefield Hills, so we hadn't really sawed off the limb entirely here, and so we came back to our home, and I had the good fortune to start out here at Chrysler came over and had a visit with Lee in his office, and he showed me the new Chrysler products, and they were very exciting. Of course, I was particularly excited about them because there was a plethora of front-wheel drive platforms here at Chrysler, which is something that I had long been pursuing at Ford unsuccessfully. So it looked to me like there was a tremendous opportunity here to proliferate those and expand the number of products that Chrysler offered. So the whole thing was extremely appealing, and I started here at his request as a consultant, and I opened up a Della Rosa Design Associates was as you would expect a typical solution to this kind of business is to you in our profession is to use your own name, and I did that, and so I worked ended up working here at Chrysler. I took it on a 5-day a week arrangement, and I really enjoyed it. They gave me an office in the very close to the office of the vice president in charge of design, a fellow by the name of McAdam, and I was just down the hall from him, and I was up, you know, in the area where I could have contact with the staff and be a part of various meetings and so forth, and as well as getting back into the studios and looking at the attending the meetings as a obviously in that role as a listener, an observer, really. I was limited to that, and I understood that, and but it was very informative, Mac was very very cooperative, and obviously it was clear to him that my role here was to give Chrysler the benefit of another opinion, another judgment on the part of of the programs that they were pursuing here. So they had a variety of projects that they had under consideration, but I guess the prime project that was being considered was the what is known now as the G24 sports car, and so I was given an area in the studio. I was given a buck in order to permit me to develop a full-size clay model, and I was given a crew of modelers that were as well as not reporting and directly to me, but I had technical support people that would, you know, help support the development of my project and ensure that I met the feasibility requirements and so forth. And
what year was this, Mr. Morris?
This would be 1979. This was a tremendous experience, really, for me. I really enjoyed it. The crew, as well as the majority of the people that I met here at Chrysler, were very, very supportive. It was a first-class crew. I was very pleased with it, and I think I accomplished a lot. Obviously, there are, as you would expect, there are, in order to be acceptable as a consultant and not be offensive to the staff, you have to handle yourself in a unique way so that you don't come on so strong that you begin to develop an adversarial situation which is not beneficial to anybody. And I think I was able to achieve that, just really based on my own personal feeling, plus the observation of the expression of the attitude of the various employees toward me, and those things, if they're mishandled, you can obviously tell, certainly, that you've overstepped the limitations. So everything just developed beautifully, and after at about the 6-month point of my contract, Lee and I had a discussion about the product design function here at Chrysler, and in the course of the discussion, we got around to the subject of my joining Chrysler as a as an employee, and it was my my opinion on the basis of the 6 months that in order to be effective, to reach the point that I felt was fully effective, I really needed to join the company. As effective as a consultant can be, there is a limitation with that kind of an arrangement. As the situation at Chrysler developed, and I made the excuse me, the transition from consultant to vice president of design at Chrysler. In assuming that responsibility, I fortunately had 6 months of opportunity as a consultant to judge the situation at Chrysler, and that helped me a great deal because among the things that I was pleased to see here, and I think generally you wouldn't expect it from a company and its people who were in the financial climate they were in, I expected to have a predominance of negativism and defeatism and so forth, and I didn't find that. These people impressed me here as being, as they described themselves frequently in conversation. When I I spoke respectfully of my observation of them. They would frequently say, well, we're survivors. And that survivor attitude really, excuse me, really contributed a great deal to the success throughout the company, of course, and the success that I enjoy here at the design operation.
Do you think that the Drag Coke's optimism permeated the whole executive?
Yes, I think it did. In fact, I'm sure it did. The positiveness, the power that Mr. Iacocca exhibits, and his devotion, his to achieving identified goals in the short term and in the long term at Chrysler, those were all major contributors, I believe, to the attitude that contributed so much to our success internally here.
We've taken it more of an almost more of a company with a rather dull and uninteresting product line. And,
right.
What sort of steps can you see in retrospect? What transition steps are you sure?
Well, I think from a business point of view, of course, he eliminated what do they call it? This where they put the acres and acres of vehicles out against the fence. I can't recall the name of that. The Chrysler used that system, had been using it, I guess, maybe for many years. I'm not sure of that. But at the time that I joined them, this was still going through a period of elimination, and to get those vehicles, I think it occurs to me, it's called a sales bank, and the sales bank system is one where the company, in order to maintain or create a facade that things are well and they are successful and are going to succeed. With a sales bank, your production levels, you can accelerate those up to an unrealistic number, and you're building cars at X number a day, and they are banked in various open storage areas throughout the country. And then the dealer organization or the sales organization draws from this bank and ships these to the dealers. Well, of course, I won't go into a lot of the detail, but some of the detail is worth mentioning, and I guess is quite obvious. When you have cars in a bank like that, of course, the opportunity for theft, regular deterioration in the course of being exposed to weather in a stored open area like that, and during many of the periods where there was, you know, there was rain, snow, whatever, and then to try to clean those cars up and make them look like you know, quality products suitable for showroom display. This was, I would say, was impossible, and that was kind of part of the history of Chrysler. They had also serious flaws in their body engineering, which they had gained reputation, unfortunately, but I guess you would expect it. So their reputation, which they had enjoyed for many, many years as being a premier engineering company,
Zeter Brothers,
right, Chrysler Engineering, was a major focus of attention in Chrysler and historically. But while I don't really have, there wouldn't be of any value, and I don't have enough knowledge to know from you know what the situation was as far as the engineering of the drivetrain and so forth, the manufacturing of that. Perhaps that was, there had been some deterioration there, I'm not certain. But in the case of the body engineering detail and so forth, that was very, very undesirable as far as encouraging a positive reaction from the public or the potential customer. There was a, as you would expect, also I'm sure, there was a very unfortunate attitude developing in the among the dealers. They were sensing a deterioration in the company. They were experiencing declining demand as far as sales are concerned. And being private businessmen, they depended very heavily on, as any dealer does, on the performance of the corporation. So all of this in aggregate created an atmosphere which it would take a person of Mr. Iacocca's capability and capacity to achieve what he has here. I don't think there's any doubt of that. It and of course he enjoys, and as he has during, I'm approaching my fifth year now here, or into my fifth year. The response soon after I came here, although there was some, you know, it was almost as impressed as they are and were with him, of course, there was some, and recognizing as I described them that they were survivors, there was a frailty about it, well controlled, but there was a, they had seen and they would see many of their co-workers or fellow workers disappear from the scene here, because one of the other flaws, a major one at Chrysler, of course, was that they the break-even point at Chrysler was about in the general area of about 3 million cars a year. Now, it I don't have to go into any detail to I think that's quite obvious that it's in a depressed market. It would you would feel the impact of that immediately. So they disposed of plants, equipment, and they reduced the number of people. I think
white collar,
white and blue as well. Yes, you hear of, I think more frequently because of the more vocal and nature of organized labor. You hear of the blue collar worker, and he appears to be the person victimized under this circumstance. But in reality, there was a very excessively high number of white collar workers here at Chrysler. I am saying all of this, recognizing that this is Don De La Rosa's judgment that is describing this, and I'm sure there are those who could well disagree with me, but this is my opinion. As far as my organization is concerned here in assuming the responsibility for product design, two features that had come to alarm me here at Chrysler were an adversarial atmosphere, which was one, and the excessive number of people in the organization. My attention really was devoted more to the excessive side of the white collar organization, the structured pyramid approach that was had been the style of, as well as the adversarial side of it, was a style of management that was, I would say, would have to be attributed to the person I succeeded. I personally am not I don't operate well, and I'm not comfortable with. I can survive adversarial circumstances, but I don't work well in them, and as a part of my goals as far as efficiency is concerned, it seemed decidedly an inappropriate way to operate. Additionally, we had both in our blue collar area as well as the white collar pyramid, top of the pyramid, we had I can't remember the exact figure, but it was up in around 550 people here at Chrysler. And I immediately started to devote my attention both here and at home on weekends to the development of a new organization. And once I established that and carefully re-examined it, I sensed that really I could establish a goal for myself, and I really have to applaud the Chrysler management. They didn't lean on me in the developing of this. I didn't. They weren't looking over my shoulder, and I didn't. They didn't pressure me to achieve it. But I established it for myself and for this, what I believe to be the success of the product design office as well as Chrysler Corporation. Obviously, my organization is not large. As you look at the numbers in engineering or look at the numbers in manufacturing, I'm really a very, very small organization. But nonetheless, I did what I could to make a contribution to what I thought was extremely important. And so I reduced the size of my organization down to I think it was in the neighborhood of 225 people. So that's a reduction of some magnitude. Part of it was the result of my establishing goals for the cause, you could say, in order to be a supporter of what I recognized as important to the company, that we get our break-even point down to in the neighborhood of 1 million cars a year, which is which says that we can. It's a nature of the business, partially, that you establish for yourself a level, and that you can, in a car market of 8 million or 9 million, whatever cars annually, that you can be profitable and enjoy 10% of the market, 11% of the market, and you establish your headcount to represent that, as well as your facilitized side of the business, to represent that 1 million cars a year, and the management of this company did that. And in a small way, I made a contribution to that. This has been, you know, it was very successful. As I was alluding to, of course, additionally, I the numbers, rather than being a dramatic, devastating kind of reduction to me, of course, offered me a something that an opportunity to employ a management style which I was better equipped to do, and had more of a sincere desire to function with a reduced number of people, quite frankly, because the empire building side of these huge encumbered organizations, really the purpose of those is to, in many instances, is a goal building of a different sort as far as the leaders of those organizations are concerned. I think that existed here, quite frankly. They have, I know Jean Bourdonnais was a tremendous leader, and a very devoted builder of the organization to the number that it was when I left. It was a huge organization, and that was important to him and to me. To function with a more efficient and smaller organization is better suited to meet my goals. So the 225 people was worked out quite well. So we immediately started devoting ourselves to some of the areas that were not part of the operation at all here. I'd been a kind of a car building devotee, I guess, for much of my career, and so we started immediately to record our clay, our proved as well as our clays that we consider to be important candidates for consideration. We started a program of building those, having those built outside in fiberglass. So we had it served two purposes for me. One was I could establish representative cars that represented the various our various product lines, the line, the Dodge line, the Chrysler line, the Plymouth line, plus the series differences which had to be addressed. Previously, they hadn't. I don't know how they did it here, but they didn't do that. So I don't know how they made those decisions, quite frankly. But they did not build fiberglasses or have them built outside. There was only one fiberglass, to my surprise. When I came to work here as a consultant, I was anxious to see the K car, and there was just one K car, and it wasn't here. And I asked about that. Well, it wasn't here because it had been shared, as far as the investment was concerned, it had been shared with marketing, and the cost of it had been shared between the design center and marketing. Well, knowing marketing people as I did, obviously it was gone, and they had it. I don't know how.
6 months of the year custody.
Oh yeah, right. They're really hardball players on that score. So they had the car, and nobody was, you know, really understood that we should have been work had should have been already been done on the facelift. They were so concentrated on the fact they were going to introduce this car. But long, you know, prior to the introduction of that car, the the year following and the year following that should have been, you know, thought about, but it wasn't thought about, and there were no cars. So I started going outside to have these models built, much to the shock of the people in the organization. There were some misgivings about what I was up to.
Did you practice at Ford previously?
No, we built most of those inside at Ford in great numbers, because Bordenay had these incredibly big shop operations. I mean, my God, if you I don't know whether you visited the whole facility over there, but it is a incredible place. I mean, you got metal shop, a fiberglass shop, and a plaster shop, and a wood shop, and a trim shop, and I mean not little shops. These are big operations. But that was Gene's approach to business.
Also, the wind tunnel, which I think was eventually axed.
Yes, it was. But Gene wanted the wind tunnel. But that's another funny story, because Gene had always wanted a garage, and he'd always felt we parked our cars in front of the building, and in the wintertime and in inclement weather, of course, it wasn't the greatest thing in the world. So William Clay Ford parked it was the first spot, and then Bordenay, and then myself, and it went right down the line, all under a roof that covered the entrance to the building. But of course, during the winter, it was pretty raw. You know, you go to your car and get in there, and you have to scrape the snow off of it and so forth. So Gene had longed for a garage. And Gene, being an ingenious fellow, decided that the way to get a garage was to get another building. And what better would serve as the cause than to have the building house a wind tunnel?
You've traditionally gone off the site to have wind tunnels.
Yes, as we do here, yes, down to Lockheed in Georgia and as well as some other places where I think Ford had they had a temperature a wind tunnel, very limited wind tunnel, where they could do cooling studies and things like that, but never had quite a large one, as I recall. I was in it a couple of times during my career. It was impressive, but it was not engineered as a full wind tunnel as they have at General Motors now. Anyway, that was a two-edged sword that Gene carried. There was the wind tunnel and the garage. So it was really kind of had a little humor.
I remember eating at the styling cafeteria many times, being across the street, and noticing the pecking order. I noticed for several years you enjoyed the driving the things which you probably had a hand in, the designer Lincolns.
Yes, right. Yes, right. Yes. Yeah, I would always, I stayed with those very, I worked on the Mark program, the 4 and 5, and those were quite, those were to me, the luxury car. They were just fabulous. It was a nice.
Did you have a hand in getting the various designers involved, like Givenchy and Bill Glass and others?
No, that was done through, I think, I may be incorrect about this, but my judgment sort of tells me that that it would be something that the head of K&E would do. Kelmanson, I think he's very active in that area, and he's a mover and shaker, and I think he would that would be the kind of thing that I would credit him with.
At the risk of interrupting your train of thought, could you take us back to 1979 when you accepted Mr. Iacocca's offer to come to Chrysler? Interesting that a key figure had already come over from Ford, Harold Sperling.
Right.
And that even before Mr. Iacocca.
Right.
And could you describe that situation in some, as it turns, as it impacts on product design, and what Mr. Iacocca's directives were to you, to how many years did you have to come up with a new line of cars? How did you work that out? In terms of, you mentioned that you slimmed down the your department to a leaner mix, mm-hmm. and you were succeeding someone who had a different point of view than you and Mr. Iacocca. Can you expand a bit on that in terms of product design and product mix, and whether Mr. Spurlick had any hand in that at all?
Right. Yeah. Well, yes. From the standpoint of a product mix, of course, the Spurlick was he was at that time was vice president of product development. I considered myself a very important participant with product development, although I reported directly to the chairman. But I had a common interest in the goals of product development, and while I have felt that it's important that that product design not report to them, that's a personal opinion. Some companies they do, and some companies they don't. We don't, but it my. As well as being involved in design, of course, a very important part of my thinking during my career has been in an area that is called product planning. As I've said earlier in this interview, I've spoken to various designers during my career about this, that the importance of a designer being avoiding grunt status, the most important thing perhaps is that he use his head and think about product from the point as we see product planners coming to represent the thinking side of the business. So in approaching the business as I saw it as part of my domain, I started to work on car lines, and I did devoted considerable time to long-range plans for the company as far as product was concerned. And I developed a vehicle that was called the G29, which took the G24 and proliferated it into an area that I thought was extremely important to the company, and that is to give us the goal was to give us an Olds Cutlass fighter in a coupe. I thought it was a very beautiful car. I still have it down in storage. I think I was right to this day. Unfortunately, nobody agreed with me, and
no.
I have to say also, of course, there's no question that things would be different today with the financial circumstances we're in. The money was extremely short, and for them to approve a $250 or $300 million program of my meeting my goals would have been, I guess perhaps you could say, next to impossible. But it was an impossibility that I thought was very important to this company. The Olds Cutlass has enjoyed a long period of success, and reputationally has been important to General Motors and Oldsmobile, and I wanted to go after that. And I used to, in conversation with the chairman and others, talk of the G24 in less than complimentary terms, and I referred to it as a boy racer, because it's a class of vehicle which is, you could say, well, it's youth oriented. Yes, it is. But there are other youthful people who want a more acceptable notchback coupe, and so this to me was a boy racer. But I finally tired of that reference, and the world moved on.
Can you describe it in some detail as to
Well, it's I used the basically the front end of the G24. So it had a very sporty and aerodynamic look on the front end, but I used a roof that was in miniature, really. It was like an Eldorado, a blind quartered roof with quite a vertical backlight. It ironically, it has, although it's a different scale. That is, it's a more lean and a more sporty car. It has a lot in common with the Cougar that Ford brought out. I mean, it's quite a bit, quite similar to the Cougar, except it didn't have a quarter window. It had a blind quarter, because I was trying to get a mass over the rear wheel in relationship to the rear wheel. It kind of met my demands, and it is a beautiful car. I was just,
how far did it get to the fiberglass drivable?
Not to drivable, but I did do a fiberglass of it.
Full
in
size.
Fact, they never saw it here in the company at all until I finished it. At that time I was I was getting into the challenge approach of doing programs, product plans and program plans, and for the designer to do those effectively, not only does he have to use his head, but he has to get these cars built. And of course, coming out of GEA and building 20 cars a year, I've been into that a long time, and I had the autonomy there, so I designed the cars and built the cars either in steel or fiberglass or apple wood, and some drivables, the cars that suited my program strategies. And here, to the degree that I, with the limitations of the money I had to spend, which was somewhat restricting, I started to perform pretty much as I had at GEA. And so I built this G29, had it built outside in fiberglass, and it had painted black. It was, and I showed it to the chairman as part of a committee that the chairman asked that we organize here, called the Product Design Committee. And the Product Design Committee still is intact this day, to this day.
Chairmanship?
No, the chairman is the chairman. I'm the vice chairman of it.
Include other areas like product planning?
Yes, we include product planning, we include engineering, and we include the president, the vice chairman. We include the head of manufacturing at his request, and it makes sense. I was a little reluctant to expand the membership of it, but I could see the judgment in doing that. It's just that As the membership grows, they get a little more difficult to control and to manage and to keep the thing running efficiently and smoothly, because a lot of the
the members are, although this is we just had one of these meetings yesterday. I was pleased that the there's been a maturity, if I may, develop with this the existence of this, and of course we have now a even a super committee called the OTC, which is Mr. Bidwell and Mr. Iacocca, Mr. Greenwald, and Mr. Sperling, and that is the that committee deals with the things of most magnitude to the company from a business point of view as well as product, so we have there's a subtle a degree of duplication between the OTC and the PDC, but the PDC is still functioning. And as I say, yesterday I was very impressed with the absence of comments, unsolicited kinds of comments that were originally were always a problem with a committee as it grows. It must be human nature because there seems to be judgment on many people's part that they must say something. And they must, the thing that most frequently, the category that they most frequently use is to say something negative or something probably even more risky than that, and is to try to be humorous. You know, those, because those are not things that are I as even as a, as the person who's who is who finds, you know, places the importance of this kind of committee, and it is important. But I'm the person who is victimized by behavior like that. But it was very very mature, very well ran, very well. And of course, the thing that is always in evidence is that the chairman is very, very gifted as a I think personally as a CEO of a company of this size, to be as gifted in the area of product and the importance of and the actual design. I mean, he is a real participant.
Stemming from his long experience at Ford, isn't
it? Yes, I think it's something he brought into the world with him. But he is. Unusually well equipped as a in judging design, as is Harold Sperling, and as Harold is very, very devoted to, as is the chairman, to the detail and to the importance of quality, as the chairman is devoting himself presently publicly through promotional opportunities, speaking to the public in the United States about Chrysler and what Chrysler's goals are and what is their primary goal is not to be biggest but be the best, and he expresses it so well, and it is so much him, knowing him as I do. It's not something that some advertising person or promotional person has written for him or developed for him or anything like that. It is Lee Iacocca speaking in all candor.
You feel the force of his personality.
Oh, you do. It's impressive. I mean, I've been watching a series. I think second of those I saw just recently, and I've really been impressed with them. It's I recognized immediately that you it's not a, you couldn't really buy that kind of person, you know, you couldn't get a movie actor to do it, you couldn't, you know, it's really incredibly valuable. He's not only has become very good at it, but the devotion, the honesty, the credibility are come through, you know, it's really impressive to watch, and of course it's impressive to have the good fortune of being, you know, a part of these meetings where he speaks out and critiques what we've done here, he's very accurate and very helpful, and we try not to give him ammunition, and by doing something that raises so much doubt that it encourages him to speak out. So if I always consider myself more successful if he is quiet, and if he says he likes it, and that's wonderful. But otherwise,
Kenyon and Eckhart came up with that, or was it someone on the advertising staff here came up with the thought of Lee Iacocca being the actual Chrysler spokesman?
Well, I think it was Leo Kalmanson, but I'm not certain about that. But it represents Leo.
Is he a person whom Iacocca worked with the years at Ford?
Yes, he is. Right.
It was quite cool getting the whole.
It really was. Yeah, it was. It said something about how Leo felt about Iacocca. Really, I would think to come over to Chrysler when you have an account like that at Ford. That raised a lot of eyebrows and generated a lot of conversation, I'm sure, because it's.